Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Wednesday, the 28th of June. Belarus says it'll keep a close eye on the Wagner boss, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who flew there after ending his brief mutiny in Russia. At least four people have died in a Russian missile strike on a city centre in Ukraine. And India's Prime Minister calls for a single legal code ending the separate system for the Muslim minority. Also in the podcast, why Egyptians are up in arms about the soaring cost of trips to Mecca for the Hajj. And
I had entered the first time in 2009. It's 9 times I've actually entered.
With different stories each time?
Of course, yeah.
9th time lucky, we meet the first Jamaican to win the prestigious Commonwealth Short Story Prize. The man who apparently brokered a deal to avert a civil war between the Russian military and Wagner mercenaries on Saturday has been explaining how he did it. The Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, said he first urged the Russian leader not to kill the Wagner boss, Yevgeny Prigozhin. "I said to Putin, we could waste him, no problem, but don't do this." Then, in an expletive-filled phone call, he says he persuaded Mr. Prigozhin to call off his advance towards Moscow, saying the Russian leader would never give in to his demands to abandon his defense minister and army chief.
I say to him, no one will ever hand over Shoigu, Gerasimov or anyone else for that matter, especially in this situation. You know Putin as well as I do. He says, but we want justice. They want to strangle us. We will march on Moscow. And I say, halfway to Moscow, they will squash you like a bug.
Mr. Lukashenko confirmed that he'd given Wagner security guarantees as part of the deal, and that Yevgeny Prigozhin had arrived in Belarus on Tuesday. Mr. Lukashenko was speaking after President Putin made a high-profile address to 2,500 military personnel in Moscow as he tried to reassert his authority. I asked Olga Ivshina of the BBC Russian service what she made of the latest comments from the Belarusian president.
He likes to project an image of a powerful man in control. He uses quite a lot of harsh language, harsh jokes, so to say. He has been in the shadows for quite a while. But also, I would like to underline that before, he was sometimes saying some strange things which were not only not confirmed, but also proven to be not correct. So I think we should be careful with whatever he says, especially now when the ball is on Putin's and Lukashenko's side. They're going to tell whatever they would like. And of course, they're trying to show that they are the good guys and they are the savers in that situation. That's the message they want to spread.
Now, you have reported on the Russian military throughout the invasion. What do you think the impact of having Wagner fighters in Belarus will be?
First of all, today Lukashenko confirmed that there are no Wagner fighters in Belarus currently, and that's exactly the same what Ukrainian intelligence was saying. It seems they're still mostly based in Lugansk, Russian-occupied part of Ukraine. So we don't really know where they're going to move and when. Secondly, Prigozhin boasted that he has 25,000 men. Honestly, I'm in doubt. I have been meticulously counting Russian losses, including Wagner losses, since the start of the invasion. And our estimate is he might have, most optimistically, 10,000 people, bearing in mind all the losses his units have sustained. And thirdly, currently, Russian forces are holding their defense position, trying to sustain Ukrainian counteroffensive strikes. And Wagner troops, neither during this this invasion nor in the past during their operations in Syria, Libya, Donbass, 2014. They have never been particularly good in defensive operations. They are the storming force. So the fact that they're currently absent from the battlefield wouldn't affect much the current state of events because they have been absent since the beginning of June and they're not a defense force. But strategically, of course, this whole situation distracts the minds of Russian senior command. So this may influence Russia's strategy and morale of the troops.
And what do you make of President Putin's public appearance addressing soldiers and police officers at the Kremlin?
He needs to show he's a strong man. Authoritarian regimes, it's essential for them to project that image of strength and stability. If that's shaking, everything is shaking. And also, they need to do something with their troops because, once again, those questions of corruption, incompetence raised by Wagner, they have never been addressed. So Putin needs to do something about it, at least in the eyes of the troops which are currently based in Moscow, because if something else happens, those guys, they will be given orders to defend Putin. And to do that, you need to have trust. And I guess Putin was trying to feed them that trust and that image of a strong leader they need to fight for.
Olga Ivshina of the BBC Russian service. Well, in Ukraine, Russian missiles have once again hit civilian targets, killing at least four people, including a 17-year-old girl in a busy city centre. More than 40 more were wounded in the attack on a restaurant and shopping area in the eastern city of Kramatorsk. Belgian journalist Arno De Decker had just left the building when it was hit.
Obviously, because there is still a curfew, I was thinking of going eat somewhere. As a matter of fact, Ria Lounge, this restaurant, is my favorite restaurant. And not only me, but also other journalists, soldiers, but also volunteers and civilians. It's like a gathering hub where people drink, eat very good food. So it's a very nice restaurant. Everyone in Kramatorsk knows about this one. So I was eating there and then I left. And 10 minutes after that, I heard two huge explosions. So I went on the place and I saw dead people, people screaming, people crying, huge chaos. And there's still people underneath the rubble because it's a big restaurant. So you have maybe, let's say, 20 people working and even more customers inside on the terrace and also inside. I would guess maybe, I don't know, 50, 60 people. The restaurant was going to close at 8 anyway because there is a curfew going on. But still, it was a beautiful sunset and people were still smoking, drinking on the terrace of the restaurant. So not going home yet. It was still quite packed inside also.
Have you got any sense of casualty numbers?
Honestly, it's totally, totally destroyed. So it's gone. There is no restaurant anymore. And it was a huge place. So I'm not sure, but I think it might be a severe number, I'm afraid.
I guess it's just a terrible reminder that, you know, while we understandably have been sort of gripped by the events inside Russia over the last few days, that the war in Ukraine, the violence in Ukraine is still very much happening.
Yep. Especially now it's getting very personal for a lot of people, also for foreigners and journalists who come to Kramatorsk, because this place is like a hub for everyone since months now. And so I think, including me, we tend to forget that those places can be particularly targeted by the Russians. So I think everyone sitting in that restaurant knew somehow, okay, at some point something is going to happen, because if Russians are smart enough, they will bomb this place because it's just packed with the volunteers and soldiers and journalists. But I think that everyone was saying, okay, well, maybe it might happen, but I will surely not be here. It will not be now. But now this is a painful reminder that the war is actually still going on, even in Kramatorsk, which is considered like more or less okay regarding to the distance to the front. But no, absolutely not. It's a tragedy that it's unfolding here.
Belgian journalist Arno De Decker talking to Tim Franks from Kramatorsk in eastern Ukraine. The Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has called for a single legal code to be introduced that would apply to all citizens, a move opposed by the Muslim minority, which is governed by separate laws on some matters. Addressing supporters in the state of Madhya Pradesh, the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister said a country cannot function with a dual legal system. With more details, here's our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan.
A number of minority religious groups in India, including the country's 200 million Muslims, are governed by special laws on matters like marriage and property. The Muslim personal law came into existence during the British colonial period in 1937. Muslim men are allowed to have four wives under Sharia law. The practice also exists in some tribal communities, while polygamy is banned in most other groups. Muslim leaders say the move to impose a uniform civil code goes against the spirit of the Indian constitution. But activists point out that the Supreme Court of India in 2017 struck down the Islamic practice of triple talaq that allowed a Muslim man to divorce his wife in minutes. Critics say the implementation of the Uniform Civil Code is one of the key agendas of the Hindu hardliners, who argue that it would ensure equality.
And Marisa Netirajan reporting. Around 10% of organ transplants around the world are thought to be carried out illegally, as part of a lucrative trade in which poorer people are paid or forced to become donors. Three people were convicted in the UK earlier in the year in a case involving a powerful Nigerian family and a vulnerable Lagos street trader. Police in London say they are still investigating other outstanding suspects. The BBC has learnt that a number of other cases have also been referred to the British authorities. Mark Lobel reports.
London court sentences former deputy Senate President Ikekwe Imada to jail for organ trafficking.
The three were found guilty after facilitating a young Nigerian man's travel to the United Kingdom in a bid to obtain his kidney.
The BBC met the victim's friends and family in Nigeria. His best friend says he was enticed with the promise of a job in the UK when he was working from a basic market stall in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. The brother of Daniel, the name we're using for our victim, says the family's been worried sick ever since Daniel took up that opportunity without telling them and disappeared.
Has he been in touch?
No.
Not once?
No once. Even for his brother, for his mom, for his family, no one, no message.
He had been promised a better life in the UK and so had boarded a plane for the very first time, leaving his home in Nigeria. Now he was sitting in a London hospital and he suddenly realised the true reason for his journey. It gave him the fright of his life, as Detective Sergeant Andy Owen, the investigating officer into his case, told the BBC.
He said it was there that he became aware what he was going to be doing, and that was going to be giving a kidney to a stranger. He described the fear of this. And when the doctors were talking about the risks, the small chance of death, the need for ongoing, lifelong, ongoing medical care, real and true fear within him.
Daniel had been trafficked to the UK by the powerful Nigerian politician Ike Ekweremadu, his wife, and a middleman. The plan was to get a new kidney, Daniel's kidney, for the Ekweremadu's sick daughter, who also lived in the UK. Daniel escaped and ran to the police after doctors at a London hospital stopped the transplant taking place. Suspicious, Daniel did not know why he was there and was being financially coerced, which would have made the transplant illegal. The police investigation was unprecedented. It included the dramatic arrest of Ike Ekweremadu on the tarmac at Heathrow Airport, and police officers had to fend off what they called an audacious intervention from Nigerian senators to have the trial moved to Nigeria. Nigerian Senator Adamu Bulkachua defended that move.
We just tried to bring him home. He was a serving senator, don't forget.
Some would say you'd want to do that so that he would get an easier ride in Nigeria.
No, not really easier ride, but we will do it in accordance with the laws. After all, we are also signatories to the human trafficking laws internationally.
Investigations into Daniel's case remain ongoing. That's not all. The police have told us they're investigating a separate case in which an Indian man in his 60s has been arrested on suspicion of conspiring to exploit a person for organ removal. He's currently on bail. The BBC has also been told of another referral to police by the Human Tissue Authority, which has to approve all living organ donations before they can take place. As for our victim Daniel, who made history, he had a lucky escape and is now in police protection. But both he and his family told us they fear revenge attacks from supporters of the man he had jailed. Daniel feels it's unsafe to return to Nigeria, and it's possible he'll never see his family again.
Mark Lobel. 4 years ago, the multimillionaire sex offender Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his New York cell while awaiting trial. His death was ruled a suicide, but claims that he was murdered to ensure his silence have swirled ever since. On Tuesday, the US Justice Department's watchdog confirmed that Epstein did indeed take his own life. But in a scathing report, it blamed jail staff for not searching his cell or checking on him in the hours before he died. Our North America correspondent David Willis told me more about the findings.
Well, this is a damning report, Oliver, by the Justice Department's Inspector General, Michael Horowitz. It concludes that what he calls negligence, misconduct and job performance failures, some of it rising to the level of criminality on the part of more than a dozen prison staff, was to blame for Jeffrey Epstein's death. And it says that despite regulations requiring checks to be made on inmates twice an hour, Jeffrey Epstein was left alone and unmonitored for more than 8 hours before he was found dead. And prison officers then attempted to falsify records to cover up their errors. Now, the report also says that internal warnings about Mr. Epstein's deteriorating mental state were ignored, despite the fact that shortly before his death, he was placed on suicide watch after he was found with a piece of cloth around his neck, which his cellmate at the time said had been part of a previous attempt to commit suicide. Now, once that very same cellmate was transferred to another facility, Jeffrey Epstein was never assigned a replacement, despite warnings that he needed to be placed under supervision. Now, this report also identifies other irregularities in treatment, which led to Jeffrey Epstein being afforded, for example, extra bedding, which ultimately he used to commit suicide. And it blames failures in prison infrastructure, such things as understaffing, outdated surveillance cameras and so on, as contributory factors in his death, Oliver.
David Willis in Washington. Still to come on the Global News podcast. The sound which could help warn pedestrians about e-scooters. Hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims to Saudi Arabia spent the day on Mount Arafat for the high point of the Hajj. Temperatures reached 45 degrees Celsius and thousands of health workers were on standby. More than 1.8 million worshippers are taking part in the annual Hajj pilgrimage, nearly double the figure from last year, but well short of the record 2.5 million which had been expected. One of the reasons for that slightly lower number may be the cost of going. In Egypt, there's been controversy over how much people are being charged to travel to Mecca, as I heard from Sally Nabil in Cairo.
The prices have almost doubled compared to last year. The cheapest trip costs around $6,000 per person, which is a very big figure for an average Egyptian. We are talking about a country inhabited by more than 100 million people, most of them Muslims, and nearly 30% of them live below the poverty line, according to government figures. We have an inflation rate of almost 40%, so that can give you an idea about what $6,000 means to an average Egyptian family.
Yeah, why are the prices so high? Is it a result of pent-up demand following the end of COVID?
Not just that. It's mainly because of the sharp devaluation of the country. Over the past year, the Egyptian pound lost more than 50% of its value against the US dollar, and the prices of everything have skyrocketed. So Hajj prices are not an exception. We've been talking to a manager at a private tour operator in Cairo, and she told me that bookings have significantly dropped compared to last year, and she cites the cost as the main reason behind that. She said that you used to have customers who performed Hajj a few times before and they want to go once more. Now it's mainly those who are going to Hajj for the first time. And just to explain to our audience, Hajj is required from a Muslim just once in his or her lifetime, provided that he or she is both physically and financially capable to do that.
So how do people feel if they are priced out of being able to go on the Hajj?
They are very frustrated. I've been talking to people who have been saving for years. For them, it's a dream to go to Hajj. And now they are shocked when they have a look at the price list and realize that all their savings are not enough. If you even think about borrowing, getting loans from the bank or loan from a relative, and they burden themselves with huge financial debts to be able to make it.
Our Cairo correspondent, Sally Nabil. The captain of the England men's cricket team, Ben Stokes, has said he is deeply sorry to hear about discrimination in the sport after a major report found it was elitist and exclusionary. The Independent Commission for Equity in Cricket warned there was widespread racism and sexism and that young players were being put off by prejudice based on social class. The England and Wales Cricket Board admitted it faced an existential problem, but said it was determined to act. Here's our sports correspondent, Andy Swiss.
The report could hardly have been more savage. Racism, it said, was entrenched in cricket. 87% of people with Pakistani and Bangladeshi heritage who responded to the survey said they'd experienced discrimination. 82% of people with Indian heritage and 75% of all black respondents. Maurice Chambers says he encountered racism at Essex County Cricket Club. An investigation is ongoing. He wonders whether young black players will consider cricket as a career.
How many people of my background do you see playing professional cricket? There's not many of them. Is this the kind of stuff I'm going to be faced when I'm in whatever club that I'll be playing for? Nobody wants that.
The commission also heard evidence of a widespread culture of sexism and misogyny and expressed alarm that England's women had never played a test at Lord's, while the ground continued to host an annual fixture between Eton and Harrow. Such elitism, the report found, was prevalent. In 2021, 58% of England's male players were privately educated, compared to 7% of the general population. Brian, who lives in Oldham and is involved in coaching, says not enough is being done to help poorer children.
If a kid gets selected for Lancashire, a lot of the time, you know, they're paying for their own kit and the time of the games is during the week. So parents have got to take time off work. A lot of these parents, they don't have manual jobs, you know, they're working to feed their families and they've got a talented kid. And I just think there's a lot of things that the counties could do to help them out.
The England and Wales Cricket Board has issued an unreserved apology and it was echoed by Ben Stokes. Cricket said the England captain needed to celebrate diversity on all fronts.
I am Ben Stokes, born in New Zealand, a state-educated pupil who dropped out of school at 16 with one GCSE in PE. I needed help with the spelling and grammar in this speech, and I am currently sitting here as the England men's test captain. It is clear there is so much more the game has to do, and as players, we really want to be a part of that to ensure that this is truly a sport for everyone.
The government said the report made for difficult reading, adding that cricket needed to deliver clear and sustained cultural change.
Our sports correspondent, Andy Swiss. E-scooters may be a handy way to get about, but spare a thought for pedestrians who can't hear them coming. Well, an acoustic engineer from the University of Salford here in Britain is working on a solution. Antonio Torija Martinez spoke to the BBC's Johnny Diamond.
We need to produce a sound that is detectable. We need to produce a sound that is accepted by the rider. And we need to produce a sound that is not contributing to noise annoyance to the communities around. So absolutely, it's a quite challenging process.
Let's listen to the first one you've got on offer. Let's hear it first of all. Okay, that is sound one. What's good and what's bad about that?
Well, that sound is a continuous sound. We've been selecting the frequency in order to pick at the maximum sensitivity to make them frequency sensitivity of humans to make them detectable. So the good thing is that for the rider perspective, this could be less annoying.
Right.
But for a pedestrian perspective, it's probably less noticeable.
Let's hear sound two. Okay, variation on a theme there. What you've added something there. What does the little addition make?
Yeah, in this one, it's the same frequency, but in this one, you can notice it's a small impulse sound we added. So this is just some repeated notes. That's to increase the detectability. Yeah.
Okay, and sound number three. Oh, very different. That's very different, isn't it?
Yeah.
Quite annoying.
In this one, yeah, This one is a fully impulsive sound. Again, the same frequency content, but the amplitude modulation in this sound is much higher. And this is to maximize detectability.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, it's difficult. I think most pedestrians we are interviewing are more interested in the impulsive one, the third sound. We are hoping to get a response from the community to see what is our recommendation.
Antonio Torija Martinez talking to Johnny Diamond. The Commonwealth Short Story Prize is awarded to the best piece of unpublished fiction in one of 12 languages from anywhere in the 56-nation Commonwealth. It's just been won for the first time by a Jamaican writer, Kwame McPherson, for his story Okohi. He spoke to Razia Iqbal.
I'm a lover of history, and one thing that I love about history is in terms of African diaspora. When I mean African diaspora, I mean African-Caribbean, African-American story. And one of the things that I realized when I was doing my research was that in the 19th century, early 20th century, there were a number of black towns in the United States, and majority of them, all of them, were actually razed to the ground. A few of them had massacres. Okohi is one of those places. And I decided to write a story based on having Okohi as a background. So what happened is, which happened in a number of towns, is there was some altercation between two black residents and white residents. And then the white residents all combined and basically razed the town to the ground, killing over 500 black people.
The story focuses on an African-American man driving through an American landscape and is stopped by the police. There clearly are several ideas that you wanted to get across in this story.
That is correct. Background for me was trying to bring elements of history into modern-day living, for example, and how everything is connected. So the police stopping is an element of that in regards to, it could have been African-American or African-Caribbean person driving through the countryside and being stopped. And then along the way, all the ancestral stuff came into play and aspects of Caribbean, Jamaican aspects came into it also. So I try to bring in different elements of African diaspora stories, ancestral aspects of it, Jamaican folklore, and a bit of sci-fi, and so I try to create a connection within the story of the richness of African Caribbean and African American experience in the diaspora.
Indeed, without spoiling the story for people, because presumably you would like people to read it, exactly. There is something that happens in the story that includes the kinds of things that you're talking about. So Jamaican folklore and almost like a ghostly presence. And I'm assuming that you're talking about the presence of ancestral ghosts.
Exactly. And that's where I try to make a connection, because one of the aspects of being an African out of Africa is the connection that we have and the connection we should have of those who went before. So I try to bring that into the story as an element to show that this is a part of who we are.
You are the first Jamaican to win this prize. What does that mean to you?
It's still surreal. Honestly, I didn't expect to be where I am. It's mind-blowing. I'm proud to represent my country, proud of that. My friends and family are excited by the whole thing. But it's still surreal. Still trying to absorb the magnitude of it all, it's going to take some getting used to.
You have tried many times, 7 times, in fact, you've entered this prize.
Well, actually, it's more than that. I had entered the first time in 2009. It's 9 times that I've actually entered.
With different stories each time?
Of course, yeah.
I wonder what it is that you think about this story that resonated with the judges.
I think it's the humanness of the story. And like I said, the different elements that are within the story itself that, the judges liked.
Is it also the importance of not forgetting history? I mean, I imagine that there are towns that are like this in America that people don't even know the names of or what happened in them.
Exactly. And there were so many towns that were razed to the ground because of racism in the 19th and 20th century that we shouldn't forget. Someone said to me they didn't know. And I said, well, if you do your research, you'll see that there were a number of flourishing black towns that existed due to racism that destroyed and a number of people were killed. So, we mustn't forget. If you forget history, then you'll be liable to repeat it. We have to make sure that we keep these things in mind and make sure that we keep telling the stories.
Commonwealth Short Story Prize winner Kwame McPherson. Pasuri is a pop folk track from Pakistan that's had nearly 600 million views on YouTube since its release last year. Performed by Shay Gill and Ali Sethi, it's one of the biggest hits to emerge from South Asia in recent years. On Monday, India's Bollywood film industry released its own version of the song, and it's been panned by many fans of the original. Here's a small taste first of the hit from Pakistan, followed by India's remix, which has had over 9 million views. Well, Zoya Mateen from BBC Delhi told James Reynolds more about the song and its meaning.
The Urid Chori is sung by two really famous Pakistani singers, Ali Sethi and Shay Gill. Shay Gill actually broke onto the scene as an influencer. It was a part of Coke Studios Pakistan, which is South Asia's, not just Pakistan's, perhaps most popular music show. Also the longest running music show in Pakistan. The song is essentially a fun ballad about two star-crossed lovers who are unable to meet. And it kind of picks on, you know, the traditional raga style. It's got a very catchy pop hook. It's laced with beats that are very jumpy and dancey. It's also shot in a really fun way with lots of fluorescent aesthetics. And, you know, you have Ali and Shay kind of just grooving around. It had like all the ingredients of being a smashing dance number, which are hugely popular in South Asia. When it released, it was just everywhere. People were singing it on Instagram Reels. It was topping charts consistently for months. I think we all have memories of feeling a bit tired of listening to it all the time because everybody was humming Pasuri or trying to sing Pasuri or attempting a version of it.
And now there's a new version in India. How has that been received?
Not so well. Most listeners seem to be a little wary of why there is another version to begin with, given how successful and perfect the first one was. So the song features in a Bollywood film, which releases later this month. It stars fairly well-known actors, but they're not really that big on the scene yet. People just don't like the fact that somebody decided to mess with the song, which is so special to so many people. Bollywood's been kind of rehashing old films and music, you know, like kind of churning out remixes. And not all of them are faring well with the audiences who are kind of sick of listening to the same thing.
I can imagine, We often on this programme and on the news more generally spend a lot of time talking about long-running tensions between India and Pakistan. But here's a completely different side to that relationship where people on one side of the border are happily listening to songs made on the other side.
You know, despite tense relations, India and Pakistan have always shared a very deep affinity for each other's art and culture. Millions of Indians, millions of us still hum to legendary Pakistani singers such as Ghulam Ali, Abida Parveen. And generations of Pakistanis have grown up on a steady diet of Indian films, watching Bollywood films, as much as we in India love watching Pakistani TV soap operas. So this cultural exchange is not new. But I guess what Coke Studio managed to do was transcend a lot of bitterness, which heightened recently because of, you know, political differences and hostilities, into something very beautiful.
Zoya Mateen of BBC Delhi talking to James Reynolds. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.